Okay, well, thanks for making it here, even though I got left off the program. So I want to talk about this, the proposition that archives can be considered as publishers of endangered languages documentation. And along the way, in motivating that, I want to give you a bit of an idea about what we've been doing at ELAR, in particular the launch of the new version of our archive last year. Now, some of you probably do know of us. We're the archive of the Hans Rausing Endangered Languages Project at SOAS in London. And as that, our main focus is archiving the outcomes from the ELDP-funded project, but we actually archive endangered languages, digital materials from all kinds of places, including Dell-funded. So, we archive documentation. What is that? Well, you've probably heard many, many talks about that. I just wanted to pick out a couple of ideas to get going. So if you look at a very well-quoted article by Tony Woodbury from Language Documentation and Description, he talks about a diverse, large, ongoing, distributed, opportunistic, transparent, preservable, ethical, portable thing that you do. And he talked about natural discourse data being made accessible through interpretive apparatuses, including catalogues, translations, notes, commentaries, exegeses, and summaries. But while we've had much high-level discussion about documentation and many important low-level contributions, for example, building of software by the MPI in Nijmegen, and a lot of discussion about technical formats and so on, there's been something in the middle which has been largely left out. And that's got something to do with like what documentation actually looks like, what it smells like, what its form is. And in dealing with that issue, which was something we had to do to get our archive up and running, so we heard about other archives and the issues they had, for example, of reconciling data sets. One of our issues was dealing with this missing middle, which in turn made us think about the concept of archives as publishers. Now, in my brief experience, it seems to me, talking to documenters, that their perceptions was that document has been, until quite recently, the documentation is fieldwork plus descriptive linguistics plus archiving. And, you know, with some ethics thrown in and lashings of technology. And what that meant was that people looked to archives for anything which wasn't really fieldwork or linguistics. So archives were expected to deliver the good word on how to make good recordings, how to manage data, encode files, how to create metadata, and those kinds of things. But there's been this unasked question about what the form of documentation is, the shape of the products, and it has been barely theorized or discussed. And for the unasked question, maybe the unspoken answer is a sack of files theory of documentation. But in the recent period, there's been some people thinking about this issue. For example, Gerrit Dimmendaal last year published something saying the next big challenge facing language documentation is the discovery and adoption of software interfaces that make aesthetically appealing documentation that can be easily and flexibly used. Even more recently, in fact not yet, but about to be released in the Cambridge Handbook of Endangered Languages, Tony Woodbury asks in the very last section of his chapter, in what forms should documentation be stored and disseminated? Now, that's not to say that nobody has made a contribution in this area. So I'm going to mention a couple of them, of different types. And I think in reverse order. So people that have thought about the issue of what is a documentation, what does it look like, how does one approach it, navigate it, use it, and so on. So a recent one from one of our grantees, Andrei Filchenko, for example, he's used hypertext. So he's used web documents. I've got them here for convenience as PDFs. So at the top level, rather than a directory structure of files, he's given us various links. And you can see here is a lot of data with links and also to audio and if we were to navigate through that, we find more data, including nice things like photos. Sorry, I should line that up. Photos with some caption type metadata. So that's one take on it. Nick Teberger, who will be well known to most of you, has created some audio, some software called Audiamus, which is meant to link texts with media. So this is a way of presenting documentations. Peter Austin, who you'll also know, some years ago talked about his Maliangappa database, a model for fully articulated and richly described corpora using Shoebox as a hypertext viewer. Now, this is not a bunch of spaghetti and ladders, but this is actually a data model. This is not what one is meant to look at, but it lies behind the presentation here in Toolbox, or Shoebox, I guess, as it was then. Most importantly, though, we've got IMDi, the IMDi browser, and the technologies that go with it from the Max Planck Institute in Nijmegen, which offers a conceptualization of the shape of a documentation. In fact, a whole corpus of documentations. And I guess many of you have looked at this at some time. So there's a representation here of a given deposit and what are called sessions, and then files within that. Now, that's actually really important, I think, in the evolution of our field, because it's one of only two games in town for conceptualizing the shape of a documentation. And the other game is one that I think we've seen in some of the previous talks, which is search. So what can we do? We can browse, as we've seen with the IMDi browser, or typically online resource discovery via some standardized metadata. So you can search, and you know, we've heard talks about that kind of thing. And where access control was required through some identity-driven thing like your membership of a university network. But actually, access seems to be a bit more important than that for our field. I mean, if you believe, as I do, that in the longer term, that documentations and the archives that hold them are going to be really important vectors for the transmission of languages, then actually access to documentation via archives means access to language and cultural heritage. So I'm going to look at some access issues briefly and show how they, hopefully show how they led up to thinking about publishing. The first one, audiences. So we actually have many audiences, and we've heard people talking about that in some ways, or as I'm putting it here, stakeholders. Who are the stakeholders in language documentation? Well, of course, you've got documenters. And then you've got, as a separate entity, we should recognize their projects, which need to get funding and have outcomes and so on. You've got the language consultants that people work with, and then the communities within which they live. We've got institutions who care because they're hosting projects or they're looking at documentations as criteria for selection. And then you've got various kinds of users, researchers, and people doing perhaps language revitalization work, journalists, the general public who are just curious, and heritage users from communities who might be interested in our language documentations to address other matters of their heritage. Well, this would be pretty hard to address, but really the question boils down to what goes there to provide access to something for these stakeholders. Well, the next access topic is interface. So we believe that the interface, the way that the documentation is presented, the semiotics, the aesthetics, the functionality, is really important. And so here is actually quite accidentally, I didn't know that Carmen was the chair of this session. And I also forgot my laser pointer, so I need this. I've got this live as well, but just for safety, I'm using screenshots. So here is what we call the home page of a deposit in ELAR. And on this side here, we have a sort of navigation panel. And on this side here, we have a kind of context. It's a kind of metadata panel. There's a bit of mashup thing going on here with some Google Maps connected to our main overall map. And then in this center panel is supposed to be a user-friendly way to reach out to various audiences. And notice there's some Spanish, which will be relevant to the community members, as well as the names of participants. So one of our agendas is leveling the playing field between researchers and community members and others. So I'm afraid to say, Carmen, when people come to this page, they don't have to remember the name of the linguist who came 3, 4, 5 years ago. They can just go directly to their uncle's name or something, and then they can start to access materials. I want to draw your attention to this part here, which is what we call access protocol. It's very highly developed in our archive, and I think it's one of the most highly developed ones around. What this is doing is constantly presenting on the screen, as well as monitoring the access protocol for the object, in this case the whole deposit. I'll explain what that is in a moment. And the access protocol or value for the user. Now you see, I'm not logged in, so I have no access roles, I have no access rights. So this system actually, it's called IRX. We had to do that because the original formulation was starting with the most restrictive, but that comes out as screw. So U means that all registered users can access materials. RC reflects an ethical stance we made that researchers could not restrict material only unto themselves without allowing community members. C means community members only, and then S is actually the interesting one for us, which is subscribers. It means people who have applied through the interface, which you'll see in a moment, to get access to a particular deposit or parts within that deposit. And for those of you who know Facebook or the terms Web 2.0 or social networking, it's a kind of social networking function. So going back to the interface here, if we had been looking at Carmen's deposit and clicked on resources or clicked on here we've looked up, we've clicked on this guy here, and what we see here is the way we arrange our materials in bundles. That's very close to what IMDI does in providing some conceptual packaging, except we don't actually say what the semantics of that should be. It's very flexible. So it's found 15 bundles related to Tomas. But notice that I'm logged in now as somebody, but the action is here. The access protocol for this deposit is for subscribers, but I am just an ordinary user. I don't have permission for this particular thing. So if I came here, I could click on that link and it would send a message to Carmen, and then she would get to see something about who I am from the information I provided at registration. She would decide if I can get access or not. Now that has proved quite effective and quite popular, even though we've only got a clunky implementation of it, and actually addresses a huge amount of the way that your community thinks about access control. It's not so much about closing materials, but knowing about who's getting them and the appropriacy of it. Here's another deposit, just showing so we can go a little bit further, but in this deposit on Sami, you can see this is an open one. It's available to all users. Here I am as a user, so I would be able to search for something and progress, and here is a bundle. So we're looking at a video, there's a WAV file, there's an ELAN file. We can download that and so on. We don't have an integrated viewer yet, but we can do that. I think that's enough of... Another aspect of this interface, which is really important for us, is the fact that we think it's really important to provide lots of opportunity for browsing. And I myself am a kind of hypertext junkie, and I think it's really important, especially in our area where there are so many different terms, and as Kazuko, we're talking about different ways of spelling things and so on. So in the case of this deposit here, if you were to scroll down here, you would see more terms, right? So maybe this is the island you come from, or the name of somebody, or you're interested in pig killing ceremonies, or whatever it is, but it's all there for you. And of course, that stands in strong contradistinction to other archives like this one, which simply offers this sort of generic search interface like that. On a more positive note, given that we had the example of some Spanish material from Carmen's deposit, this is the Archive of the Indigenous Languages of Latin America from UT, and it's actually really fantastic because you can toggle the whole interface between either English or Spanish. All right, so talking here about different aspects of what really contributes to access, and then the bigger picture that we come to of publishing. Of course, it depends what access to what. So my access to some resource, what is the form of that? Obviously, typologists are going to want different things from community members. So here's an example from one of our depositors. Here's what, you know, a descriptive linguist might want, but this documenter is a community member himself, and he's created more friendly materials to be disseminated web by web across his community. Notice he doesn't need any interlinear whatever for his community. And we at ELAR are working on some even simpler and friendlier interfaces. Like this is a sort of conversation player, if you like, using speech bubbles. Now, it actually, the idea of access goes even a little bit further. Like, what counts as access? So, if you can play this file in the browser, is that access? Maybe. Or do you need to be able to download it? Is that access? Or do you need to be able to understand and use it, which is then going to depend on the amount of metadata and other contextualizing information. And actually, access also depends on perceptions of how easy something is to use. So, what do we do? What have we been doing at ELAR? Well, as I say here, we've implemented a Web 2.0 archive website that implements a strong form of protocol for access. Various depositor functions, also Web2 functions, like the depositors can edit various parts of that interface you've seen. And we've tried to broaden and facilitate access and accessibility. Well, that's all very well, but if you go back to where I began, the sack of data theory is not really very helpful for making a rational, navigable interface, right? And we expect that. We expect, like what I've shown you, I hope it's the kind of thing which we expect from all good websites now. Even books have structure that's navigable and we know how to get around and look up what we want. So you could argue that some archives have actually gone backwards in terms of access. What we found then is that we had to add value. We had to do work with the deposits that we had. We had to editorialize. We had to make decisions about their structures and presentation. Now, I just have the tiniest snapshot here. Here is just one little bit of a file listing from one deposit. And you'll see there's a bunch of files here. Well, they all kind of go together because they all say Atawa, don't they? But then some are number three, and you can see there's Didebu, but the name's not the same, but that's a wave and that's a doc. Maybe they go together, maybe they don't. Do we have to look at them? Do we have to look at all 900 files in this deposit, maybe? Here's number four, we've got morning and, okay, something's happening here. This is taboos, but this one is Akolesa. So we have to learn about this thing. Actually, Akolesa is the word in this language which means taboos. So we can find out they go together. These ones, or maybe they go together. What about this one? It doesn't have the dot. And what about this, the image here? Does that go with all this stuff or with one of them or all the other Atawas? So we have to actually make decisions about these kinds of things. And the metadata, for example, which we would draw on for creating the navigable, browsable interface actually comes out of this as well, right? So it's a lot of work. Now, this is a fairly extreme case, but a really, really rich documentation and well worth putting in the effort. So I thought, if we're doing all this work and trying to make things which look like contemporary genres online, let's call it publishing and see what happens. And a few people were a little concerned, but I really enjoyed it. I think it helps focus on what we're doing. Well, why? We're adding value. Publishers do that. We're disseminating things, obviously. Publishers do that. I heard recently at the LSA in one of the sessions that the big publishers who are still trying to set out or make arguments for their continuing role were saying that the crucial bit is peer review. Now, we don't have peer review yet, but actually the materials that end up in our archive are kind of quality control because these are all people who had to get grants and so on, and we can make decisions and we can clean things up and so on. But something else is happening on that front shortly, which I'll mention in a moment. Publishing is an achievement of recognition for an author or a documenter or a corpus creator or whatever. And the most interesting one to me is that publishing is actually a component of the scientific process, the onward advance of, you know, the discourse and testing of ideas by science. So this is actually turning into a bit of a zeitgeist. A lot of people are talking about this. I mentioned Dimmendal and Woodbury earlier. Now, here is actually a quote from an email I received recently. I'm not going to say who it's from, but the capitals are his or her own, talking about evaluating documentation, which is another part of the overall program to valorize it. Some person is going through some archive. It's not our archive, but I'm not telling you which one. And trying to develop ways of thinking about ways of recognizing and appreciating quality or its lack in terms as broad as possible. We envision reviews in places like LD&C, published from here, of particular corpora. But first we need to know what a review should look like and what a review should look for. So actually, in talking about publishing, we're opening up a wonderful set of questions which have not really been considered before. So finally, people think, well, what should the documentation look like? What would a review look for? And what the hell would a review itself look like? Another thing that feeds very strongly into this, I think, is the recent LSA declaration from last year, where it argued for recognizing the scholarly merit of language documentations and corpora and so on. Well, this clearly links to, or clearly calls for, a recognition of a publication status for those things. Well, I think this can be a fait accompli if we say we're publishing them and we all keep saying we're publishing them and we do good publishing and so on, then we'll be able to tell the relevant academic authorities, I mean, all you guys, you'll be able to tell the authorities that your documentation is published. So, some conclusions. Archives have a stake in the quality of documentations. I think archives can deliver esteem and recognition to you as documenters. Some of us are working right now on this year seeing the first reviews of documentations that are held in ELAR and perhaps other archives appearing in mainstream journals. So that's an attempt, as you saw in that email, to valorize the field which you work in. And all of this contributes to what is my greatest goal here, is to raise the level of discourse and interaction with documentation in order for people to keep evaluating what we're doing and evolving and improving it. And as I started out saying, I think archives can contribute to that if we think of ourselves as publishers.